kids listening to thousands, literally thousands of songs about heartbreak, rejection, pain, misery, and loss. Did I listen to pop music because I was miserable? Or was I miserable because I listened to pop music?
Well, music is my life, man. What do you want me to do?
Welcome to episode 122 of the Love That Album podcast. My name is Morris. Thanks for joining me as I'm recording this. It is March of 2019. I didn't do an episode in February of 2019 because I'm a slack ass. We're back. Welcoming back for his third episode. It's a thrill for me to have him back because he brings great conversation. The wonderful leader and singer-songwriter and guitar player of the Bondi Cigars and the Shane Pacey Trio, Mr. Shane Pacey. Welcome back to Love That Album.
Hi, Morris. And it's great to be back, and it's great to know that you need me.
I do need you. You're my Sally Field. I need you. I really need you. We had a good time last time. I think it was in November when yourself, myself, and Jeff Perlman spoke about XTC. And,
yeah.
Tonight's album is, you know, sort of a good companion piece. We'll get to that in a moment.
Yeah.
But what's happening with you at the moment and the Shane Pacey Trio and the Bondi Cigars?
Well, the same thing for anybody who's in the kind of blues scene. We just, it's about one gig to the next and looking forward to the next big gig, which thankfully in the cigars we get to do lots of festivals. So yeah, and stuff like that, and just the next high profile gig, and then lots of smaller gigs in between to sort of keep the fingers going. And it's always about gigs. I've not got any plans to do any more recording just yet, but as I move into this phase of my musical life, it's the gigs that interest me the most.
Sure. Now, I think I saw you post something during the week about, is it a new blues festival that's starting up in New South Wales?
No, that's one that's been going for a while. They call it the Sydney, well, did the Sydney Blues Festival, but it's out in Windsor, which is sort of like having a Melbourne Blues Festival at Geelong.
Okay.
You know, it's a good one. It's a, they're good people. Yeah, so we've got a few festivals coming up, and that's with the trio actually. So always looking forward to those. They're not only for the playing, but for catching up with people who generally you just don't get to see.
So do you find that you get a lot of return patrons who come to see you every time you play?
Yeah, we do. Thankfully, that's the case. The cigars especially, because we've had so many different eras. We're like one of those bands that people come and say, oh yeah, I like that particular era, you know, and you're going, era? What? Shut up. I don't have an era, you know, but it's true. We have had errors. People have their sort of favorite things or favorite lineups, and that's just the way it is. And you just got to be graceful about it all. You know, you really think that what's happening now is the thing, but to some people, that's not the case. I'm sure if I talk to Glenn Tillerbrook, I'll talk to him about this era.
Right.
You know, and I'm sure he'd be equally as irritated by it.
Let's talk about what it is that we're going to talk about. We decided that we would talk about the third album by the band Squeeze, or UK Squeeze, if that's the way you want to go, called Argy Bargy. Now, I decided this was one I wanted to discuss on the show because it was the final album that featured Jules Holland in the first incarnation of Squeeze. They split up, they restarted again, and then he joined them again for a whole bunch of albums before going off in a huff again. But I think this was an important album in many ways, so we'll get to all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
We'll go have a quick break. I might go grab myself a glass of water, and then we'll be back to talk about Squeeze, and we'll have a bit of an argy bargy, or hopefully we won't have a bit of an argy bargy. But you're listening to Love That Album podcast, episode 122. Morris here in Melbourne, Shane just on the outskirts of Sydney. We'll be back shortly.
We hope you're enjoying the show. You can get previous episodes at either lovethatalbum.podbean.com or lovethatalbum.blogspot.com, or search for Love That Album in the iTunes store. If you want to get in contact, please email Morris at rrkitchen@yahoo.com.au. Join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/lovethatalbum and start a music-related discussion.
everybody. Pay attention. This is an important message. I haven't got long. I wanted an hour, but people have been messing me about all day. I'm going to tell you that if you don't buy this record, you'll be making the gravest mistake of your life. You're saying to yourself, what grave mistake will I be making? I'm going to tell you what grave mistake you'll be making. You'll be missing out on listening to the most incredible band. No, not band. Let's say the most incredible conglomerate of geniuses ever to put wax their discs on record. I want you to go out and buy this record. I'm not going to tell you who it's by yet. I'm going to tell you some more about it. It's got the most fantastic guitar, fantastic keyboards, incredible drums, interesting bass, best lyrics you've ever heard since Bob Dylan, Randy Newman and Marx put together. I want to tell you that if you don't buy this, you probably won't improve your life by any means whatsoever. And the name of the band, you're waiting for it, I'm going to tell you now, brace yourself, it's Squeeze. And the name of the record is RG Bargy, not Aggie Baggy as some people will call it. People who call it that generally didn't go to school and are fairly stupid. So it's RG Bargy on A&M Records and Tapes.
Available at Listening Booth, We Three Records, Peaches and Sam Goodies.
Welcome back to episode 122 of Love That Album. Morris over here, Shane over there, and we're not going to have an RG Bargy, but we're going to discuss that very British name, RG Bargy, and probably we'll be discussing just how British this band is. We're talking about Squeeze, and their third album came out, I think, in February of 1980. They're the band which I think have been described as singing about dark themes with very bright music.
Yeah.
With the exception of their first reunion album, Così Fan Tutti Frutti, which is a dark album with dark music, but that's another conversation for another time. So... I guess the best way to start this would be to ask Shane, what is your history with Squeeze? I think you said that you actually saw them in their initial incarnation.
Well, I didn't know much about them. I think I might have heard Up the Junction. Which was a weird hit in many ways because it didn't really have a chorus, which it's a bit, for that time, incredibly melodic. So I kind of liked them, but I didn't know much about them. And they were at the Bondi Lifesaver, so I went along and didn't know any of the songs. But it was what I was interested in at the time, which was short, punchy songs, very much in the, coming from the Elvis Costello school, or Joe Jackson school that I was. It was kind of right up my street. But the main thing I remember was the drummer Gilson was just bashing the shit out of the drums and just screaming at the band to play louder and faster and harder. And I guess he was under the influence of something, because he was just, his eyes were bugging out, and it was amazing. That's my main memory, because I didn't really know many of the songs.
I've seen footage from those early days, and he always seems to be playing the drums wearing what looked like a pair of golf gloves. So,
yeah.
So that's probably so he didn't, you know, get all these blisters all over his hands. So, yeah, they indicated a very hard hitter.
Yeah, I think he had a lot more experience than they had. I think they were a lot younger than he was. I think he'd done the traps. I think he'd played in Germany and toured with well-known people. And so I think he just felt he was the driver of the band in many ways. And then I didn't get their first album, the one with the bodybuilder on the front. I might have got that later. Mm. I got Cool for Cats. Again, I still thought they were a bit of a kind of a gimmick band, a bit, I suppose, like a lighter version of Ian Dury and the Blockheads in some ways, with that Cockney kind of half-talking thing. But, you know, I think we might discuss Chris Difford's vocals a bit later, but that's where I thought they were. And then that album's got some great songs on it as well. A bit of a muffled kind of production, I thought. Then I got this one, and the production had stepped up a lot, and the songs were just snappier. And, this is where I really hooked onto them a lot and really started to like them.
Like every other kid that was listening to Top 40 radio, but I remember hearing them, so it's probably on 3XY, and watching them on Countdown, seeing that film clip, Cool for Cats.
The Indians send signals from the rocks above the pass. The cowboys take position in the bushes and the grass. The score is with the corporal, she is tied against a tree. She doesn't mind the language, it's the beating she don't need. She lets loose all the horses when the corporal is asleep.
I think it's somewhat of an irony that the two songs that they're most known for in Australia would be the two songs that their regular lead singer had no real part of.
Well, that's it, yeah.
Cool for Cats, done by Chris Difford, and Tempted, done by two album keyboardist in different eras, Paul Carrack.
Yeah, that's right. I bet that delights Glenn Tilbrook no end. This is the album that definitely hooked me in fully, because it sort of gave an indication about what they could really do.
What I like to do occasionally on the show is sort of put the album in context, into perspective, what else was around. So, you know, here we are listening to this and thinking, wow, this is from a golden age of late 70s, early 80s pop.
Yeah.
Here are some of the other songs that were big at the time. And I'm quoting from a New Zealand top 40 chart I found online from September 1979. Okay, so the big hit singles at the time. I Was Made for Loving You by Kiss. Some Girls by Racy. I wonder where they are. Some girls will, some girls won't. My Sharona by The Neck, and anyone who knows me knows that I worship at the Church of the Neck. ELO, not their finest moment in Don't Bring Me Down. Don't bring me down. Pop Music by M. London, Paris, Munich, everybody talk about. Now, do you remember this one? Born to Be Alive by Patrick Hernandez.
I certainly do. Yes, we were born to be alive. Anybody who was playing in bands that used to play in places where the disco was on in the breaks would, of course, know that song.
May you never have to hear it again. A songwriter who you mentioned not two, 3 minutes ago, Joe Jackson, is she really going out with him? Look over there. Where? Bad Girls by Donna Summer.
Good song. Rock.
Roxanne by The Police. And a song which I didn't know for many years was a cover, Hanging on the Telephone by Blondie.
Yeah. And
I love their cover, I think, more than the original. I've forgotten who did the original, but I think I actually...
It's Liam Steinberg's band, whatever they were called. Mm. They weren't a big band, I don't think.
It might have been a one-hit wonder or something. But
yeah, one of those American new wave bands that were too early for the Americans, you know.
What really struck me about Cool for Cats, which came out at the same time as those songs, besides it being such a fun melody, was just how British it was. I mean, it was obviously Chris Difford's accent.
Yeah.
But you had all these expressions which us here in the Commonwealth we got from all the TV shows.
Yeah.
Getting lines like, it's funny how the missus always looks the bleeding same. Meanwhile, at the station, there's a couple of likely lads.
Yeah.
Plus references to the Sweeney, which I was a big
fan
of.
Well, I think that line about the missus always looking the same, it follows the line about the Sweeney, because it was almost the same three actresses that always used to play the criminals' wives.
Right.
One of the actresses was Lydia LaPlante, who ended up becoming a massive writer. A bit of trivia for you.
I should be doing a podcast about British crime shows of the 70s.
Yeah. Well, that song, you could actually reduce it to being a music hall song, even with the chord changes. You know, it could be Roll Out the Barrel or, you know, Have a Banana kind of songs. If you don't have that vaguely funky backing,
it
could have come straight from, you know, Max Miller's music hall repertoire.
Well, we know that the Kinks basically were a music hall band dressed up with a rock rhythm section. So I think that's probably a fair point that you make there.
Well, I think we discussed this with the XDC. I think it's actually a common thread that runs through English pop and rock. It just keeps reappearing. It's reappeared with Blur.
Maybe pop and rock of a type. I mean, there are, you know, some bands.
Yeah,
I mean, you're never going to be able to say that, you know, band like that came a couple of years ago, like Spandau Ballet, had that sort of thing. Squeeze, they didn't start out like that. You know, they were.
No.
I mean, that first album that you mentioned, the one with the bodybuilder, that had experiments with synth.
Take Me, I'm Yours.
Take Me, I'm Yours, and then later Goodbye Girl. I thought, they're a synth pop group. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think John Cale might have talked them into that. I'm not sure how keen they would have been on it, because they dumped him after that and got John Wood.
Yeah, but by the time they got to Call for Cats, I mean, they were still sort of like doing synthy openers, I think, on that one as well. Cozy Van Tutti Frutti was full of Lindrums and synths there. So, but I think the first album that I went and bought was singles 45s and under.
Oh, yeah.
When that came out, and it was after that I sort of went back to the regular albums, or some of them anyway, if someone says to you, tell me, how do I be a good songwriter? You're just going to say, all right, these guys have written the book. Just every song on this is a gem. Every song on this is a masterclass in great songwriting. And we read a lot about songwriters who say, the song just came to my mind, or sometimes I write the lyrics first, sometimes I write the music first. Every interview that I've ever heard with those guys who said the same thing, Difford wrote a set of lyrics and Tilbrook wrote the music. It was a definite role partnership. There are some songwriters who say, oh, it's a misconception. Sometimes I did one and sometimes my partner did the other.
The line's not blurred with them, or it's like Elton John and Bernie Taupin. It's clearly marked who did what.
Actually, I heard an interview with Difford and Tilbrook from, I don't know, maybe the last 5-6 years, and they made that very comparison, you know, Elton John and Bernie Taupin. But they said that the difference with Chris Difford was that he was a guitarist as well. So maybe he was able to think musically, but he basically said, well, I just write these words and I had no idea what Tilbrook was going to do with them. And he said it was always a delight to hear what he would do.
Yeah. I read, I don't know if you've read it, Difford's autobiography.
No, I haven't, no.
I think it's different now, but for those years, his guitar's not on any of the albums, and on stage, it was turned down. The guitar's more of a prop. He did sing a bit. Yeah. I think it might be, I think he plays a bit now because he's probably got a bit better, but he himself says that he just wasn't a very good player, even a rhythm player. So if you see any live clips of them, you'd be hard-pressed to hear
Difford's
guitar.
Next, you'll be telling me that Brian Wilson doesn't have his piano plugged in on stage nowadays. Just don't tell me that.
I'm not going to burst your bubble about that one. He still plays. It's still plugged in. And Bob Dylan's piano's plugged in as well.
This might be my last episode. I'm heartbroken.
You thought all the snappy guitar solos on this album were all Chris Difford, didn't you?
Well, I did, you know. Look, actually, you know, here's the thing. When I went to see Glenn Tilbrook all those years ago, like in the early noughts, I never really sort of had any conceptions either way as to who was doing the guitar solos. And then on that night, and I realized, oh my goodness, you're not only one of the really great British singers, you're a real guitarist's guitarist. And
he's amazing.
If there was any serious doubt, I think like about a third of the way in the show, he said, okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to do a cover now. And he did Voodoo Child.
All right.
And I thought, just by the end of that song, there was no doubt in the audience that we were looking at a guy who, if he'd never sung a note, if he'd never been an A1 composer, he still would have had a place in history as a fantastic guitar player, but that was not the role of Squeeze to be putting out lots of solos. They were definitely a band, a cohesive thing. They, as I like to say so often on this show, worship the song.
They did. In fact, of course, there are great guitar solos littered all the way through their work, but what they all have in common is that they all serve the chord sequence of the song.
Right.
They're not wailing Stevie Ray Vaughan type solos or whatever, whoever was big in Britain at the time. They're definitely structured around the chords, and some of their chord sequences, we'll probably get to it, are odd.
Yes, very much.
So you can't just play your pentatonic scale like most of us would do. He couldn't do it, so he had to structure them like a jazz player in a way.
Right. Yeah, I hadn't sort of thought about there being a jazz connection, but definitely I had been thinking these are not predictable chord structures, and yet he still makes it sound, from a compositional perspective, really so effortless.
Yeah, that's the trick.
Like trying to not
to go for a few minutes in the direction of Chris Difford as a lyricist, and even if you burst my bubble here thinking that, you know, maybe he wasn't so much of a guitar player at the time, but there was no way that Tilbrook was going to kick out a guy who could write a lyric as good as him. And it's probably fair to say that when they went solo and did their own albums in their own names, Tilbrook proved to be actually a really, really good lyricist. But I'm sure he'd spent a lot of time working out what it was that made Chris Difford so good. He'd been to the Difford School of Lyric Writing, and I put a lot of Difford's brilliance as a lyricist. He must be so well read. He writes like an author.
He does.
Every song. I mean, think about it. Every song on this album, and probably every other album that they did in that period, tells a story. It's not, hey, I love you, baby, or this is what I think about the shitty state of the world. I mean, they could do that while telling a tale.
Yeah. Look, for me, in the last, say, 30 years, there's only been really three great British lyric writers, and that's him, Elvis Costello, and Richard Thompson. I'd put him equally to those two, except Difford really writes about a world that's very specific, whereas Richard Thompson will write about anything. He'll write about Baghdad or, you know, a motorbike, or he'll let his muse take him wherever. Same with Costello in a way, but Chris Difford writes about London. And he writes about people who he knows, basically, and a very specific part of London, I think.
Yep.
It's very telescoped, and that's what makes it so brilliant. It's like taking a forceps and just digging right into it. You could tell right from the start that it's all about detail.
That's what puts him in that rarefied space, that rarefied air that Ray Davies occupies.
Yeah.
My three of the Holy Trinity are going to be, you know, the Beatles, the Who, and the Kinks, but Davies as a lyricist,
of course,
he rules both those top two for me.
Yeah, but for me, yeah, I guess I meant post those guys.
Yeah, no, I understood that point. But yeah, I probably put Difford in the Ray Davies space.
Sure, absolutely, he's in that. Yeah, I mean, Ray Davies is a London guy too.
Mm.
Probably not even quite as specific as Difford, though. I think Ray Davies could put himself into the place of a man sitting in a mansion, and stuff like that occasionally. But he was going to be an English writer when he was not allowed to go to America or be part of that whole scene, that post-67 explosion of British bands. He couldn't say, I think he did decide to just be British and write about British things.
Which, lazy Sunday afternoon. And
yeah, Difford's definitely in that kind of, you put him right next to him, you know, what Davies has going for him as well, because he writes the melodies as well. So.
Yeah. Well, what I think sort of links all those guys as great lyricists is their sharp observation of human behavior. And Difford has something of what I guess you might say is like a social realist. And even though I have certain problems with him as a person, I'm going to compare Chris Difford with Ken Loach as a film director. Difford writes about the same sorts of people that Ken Loach will make a film about. And Up the Junction is a song that Ken Loach could have made as a film. The beauty about the working relationship between, say, you know, Difford and Tilbrook is it musically sounds fun. It's so deceptive. They have
a lot of these
up-tempo, happy-sounding melodies, and you have to like listen to it a couple of times to think, oh, hang on, should I have been dancing to that? When you listen to a social realist song like The River by Bruce Springsteen, you know right from the outset, he said, the music is going to tell you this is sad.
Of course, Up the Junction,
they're saying, I demand that you listen to what we're actually singing here.
Well, imagine if Chris Difford was the lyricist for Joy Division, we wouldn't be here because we'd have both killed ourselves in the 80s.
Love would have torn him apart. Look, I know that there are a lot of people who I'm friends with have said, I'm not a lyric person. You know, I prefer music, which, look, you know, to each their own, that's not the way I go. I look at the song as a package and the lyrics are a strong part of it. That's not to say that a great song can't have a shitty lyric. You know,
yeah, that's right.
There's plenty. I'm not going to quote by name because I might get myself into trouble. But there are some great songs, but lyrics shouldn't be confused with poetry.
No.
The rhyme and meter, and as long as it's not stupidly embarrassing, an ordinary lyric can still be lifted into the realm of greatness by what the music does with it. But in the case of, you know, Difford and Tilbrook, it was the perfect storm, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
So we already touched on the fact that as a band, they were very, very well. Should still say they are, because you know they exist in name. It's, you know, Diff and Tilbrook,
yeah.
And I think basically Tilbrook's solo band, the Fluffers, which I think, given their obsession with genitalia in both Squeeze and Tilbrook solo songs, I think the Fluffers is a great and appropriate name. But I digress. We spoke previously on the XTC episode, and I think it equally applies here, but they're both very British, but they both sound quite different. But there's no questioning the fact that both of these bands, where they came from, no one's thinking for a second that they're American bands of the same era. They were coming
out.
And it's unusual, because I can't really think of many American bands. You're probably going to come up with a million, but just on the spur of the moment, I can't think about American bands, certainly not of that era, that are singing about local concerns the same way that Squeeze did. I mean, you might have said, as a Canadian example, you know, earlier on, that the band were singing, you know, maybe about local things, but or they sound like a band that your parents or grandparents would have loved.
They sang about Southern America. It was a bit weird. They only had one American in the band, and they got most of their kind of view of the world from Levon, because he was the only American and he's the only Southerner. Yeah, but the only thing I can think of is Springsteen, who did write about New Jersey and. But yeah, you're right. It's not. I can't think of any, really.
I think it's more the realm of Americana, and you know, a lot of the songwriters, maybe in country music, will be writing about local concerns. But as a top 40 artist, it was those bands who we mentioned who were popular at the same time. Any of the any of the American ones. I mean, you know, Kiss or Van Halen.
Bands, especially. I think most American bands, there weren't very many intellectual bands. I mean, you had people like Burt Bacharach writing very pointed. Hal David writing very pointed lyrics where they were very specific. These little micro dramas like 24 Hours from Tulsa, and bands wise, I don't think I can't think of any. You've stumped me there.
Yeah.
Both Squeeze and Ecstasy are, to me, they're bands who used punk as a way to come forward, because punk itself, you weren't supposed to be allowed to play very well, and you weren't supposed to know very many chords, and the lyrics were meant to be political, but chants really. And I think both of those bands sort of, I think we spoke about it a little bit with XTC. They're hooked onto it by making their songs really short and fast, especially in the early days. And then their prog route started appearing very quickly, I think. Yeah, especially XTC, but Squeeze too. There's some stuff on this album that I can hear, just bits of Yes. And,
you know, oh, really? Okay.
Oh, I think not so much in, I mean, there's no long songs or long instrumental passages or anything like that, just in the adventurousness and the, you know, weird chord changes and all that kind of stuff. They were from that era. They weren't from the punk era. I think they just wanted to get past that as quickly as possible and become what they wanted to be.
But as we discussed, I think, in the XTC episode, you know, XTC and Elvis Costello and Joe Jackson and, you know, Squeeze and who knows how many other bands that we can't think of quite at this moment.
Do you remember Any Trouble? They were a favourite band of mine who were very similar. They had a couple of hits. Look them up. They're good.
Okay. But like all these acts, they were saying they love the energy of punk. But, you know, especially like someone like Joe Jackson, who was, you know, getting a degree at the Royal London Academy of Music, was never going to downplay it. But he liked that guitar sound. And even if, you know, the Sex Pistols said, look, you know, we're having a little bit of fun here. I mean, well, it's a wider story than that. But if they'd gone and said, like, on the side, we're doing this to kick a few bums in the establishment, go do what you want, but take the great spirit of it. Of course, you know, then the 80s came along with this overproduction. Thank you very much, Phil Collins and In the Air Tonight. And that fucking gated drum sound.
Yeah.
But for a time, it seemed that, I don't know whether the punks liked it, but the punk energy on those artists who we just mentioned, it was invigorated by, you know, what were the real punk bands.
I'd say that they were opportunistic in a way and hooked onto it, just taking some elements of it, like even just the look a lot of the time.
Sure.
You know, the skinny ties and all that kind of thing. Yeah, because even very early in the, because going back and listening to that first Squeeze album, there's still songcraft there. Goodbye Girl is, you could strip it of its synth and silly drum sound and make it into a great pop, Squeeze style pop single. Yeah.
Yes.
It's a great song. It's probably one of their. It's just unfortunate that it sounds like that.
that drum machine does date it, unfortunately. I definitely see your point. I mean, I wonder whether in this current incarnation of Squeeze, whether they actually do that song as a full band accompaniment rather than.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. Yeah.
Let's bring up the B word. Mm-hmm. We can say the Lennon and McCartney word if we want to say the B word. I've always sort of thought that it was the height of lazy journalism to say Difford and Tilbrook were the new Lennon and McCartney. No, they were the new Difford and Tilbrook.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, look, I can appreciate, you know, comparison for individual songs based on a progression or an instrumental style is certainly a valid thing. I mean, I do it all the time on this show, but maybe I'm just as lazy as those journalists. But the syllogistic logic of, you know, the Beatles could write a hooky pop melody, Squeeze can write a hooky pop melody, therefore Squeeze is like the Beatles. It's syllogistically wrong.
No, it's only the fact that there were pop bands who wrote clever songs, and I think it mainly comes from the fact that Glenn Tilbrook's voice is pitched right between John Lennon and Paul McCartney in its sound. It's his own voice, of course, but I think when you first hear it, you can hear both of them. And I think as he went on, it just became more of his own voice. But it definitely has both of those elements. So, as with many things, I think with people, it's more the singing. There certainly weren't Badfinger, who just sounded like the Beatles. You know? But yeah, that's all I can think of. And a willingness to try all kinds of things, which probably became more apparent on East Side Story, I think. You know,
right. That was something I was going to ask you. I mean, like, when we spoke about XTC, we said that over the course of their entire catalogue, there was a progression. Personally, I see Squeeze, the first couple of albums, sort of finding out what do we want to do. And Argy Bargy is sort of like partly on the fence of music that they'd done on the first two albums.
Yeah.
And then partly of where they were going, because I think by East Side Story, I mean, I'm not saying every album sounds the same after that, but I think they sort of pretty much decided, right, we want to do this style of melody, we want to rely less on electronics, although, you know, once again, Cozy Fan Tutti Frutti has those Lynn drums, but it's still pop melodies of a type, and I sort of think that it was, for me, it was less of a development, more just, no, this isn't quite right, no, this is not what this is what we want, and then there were different production styles on different albums, but I don't think they experimented the same way XTC did, but I don't know, what do you think? Is that fair?
I think they experimented more with song styles than with sound. I think, especially on East Side Story, I think there's, and that might have been Elvis Costello's influence, like, do it this way, try. I don't think Tempted would have sounded like that.
Wasn't that Elvis's suggestion that Paul Carrack do the lead rather than Glenn Tilbrook?
Yeah, and it was, I think when it started, it was faster, and Elvis got him to play it like an Al Green song, and then I think that suggested, well, why don't you get Paul to sing it, because he's got that kind of voice. God, I mean, I've seen clips of Tilbrook singing it, and he struggles. It's Paul Carrack's song for sure. He nails it. It's an amazing vocal performance. But yeah, I think that album especially, there's songs on there that have a string quartet on them, and African drums here and there, and all kinds of weird things, and the country song labeled with love, that's something they've never done before, but I think it was just like being eclectic in the style of song they were doing rather than sonically. I don't think that they were more interested in just being a classic kind of pop rock band, I think, through their entire history.
I mean, look, I guess if you pull out this album, Argy Bargy, which we will get to in a couple of minutes, I promise you, you could definitely say, right, this is a different album from, I don't know, for the sake of a play or some fantastic place or Frank, you could definitely say, that's from a different era. Some Fantastic Place doesn't sound stylistically like one of those early albums. It sounds a lot more serious, a lot more polished, and maybe for all of that, as much as it's got some great songs, maybe a little less fun than what Argy Bargy is, because above all else, even though it's got some serious themes on it, it does sound musically like a really fun album, and you'd love to have sort of like heard some discussions in the studio at the time. Just imagine they were having some fun there.
Both Cool for Cats and Argy Bargy were both produced by John Wood. Now, I think that's important because John Wood was a folk rock guy, really. He produced the Nick Drake albums, Fairport Convention.
Right.
The Incredible String Band. His studio, Sound Techniques, was the place where they did all of those things. And this is getting towards just before when John Wood packed it all in. I think he just said he didn't like the music the bands were coming with anymore. But he's an important part of those albums because Joe Boyd was supposed to produce the Nick Drake albums, but I think John Wood did. I think the story is that Joe Boyd just sat there and read the paper. Those albums sound different to the later ones, especially if you listen to them first. I think you might, I don't know what order you listen to these things in, but the later albums, a lot of them have got that real 80s, early
polish.
90s cut glass kind of sound that's so pristine. And both Cool for Cats and Argy Bargy have a very warm, organic, especially on the drums, sound. And I think that's a lot of that's down to John Wood, because that was his specialty, was getting those.
I know that even though albums like Argy Bargy and Cool for Cats, they do have a warmer sound. I 100% agree with you. But I guess in one way I can sort of think what dates them on a couple of songs at least is when Gilson Lavis, he's doing a fill around the kit and you're thinking, oh, you're playing Rototoms, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
No one's playing a Rototom anymore. But
yeah, Rototoms and some of the synth sounds definitely date it. But I think they're used reasonably sparingly. It still all sound like a five-piece rock band, just going through the moves in the studio. And I think they've retained that. The albums where they've used the Lynn drums and stuff, they don't do much for me. I might appreciate the songs, but that sound isn't one I like very much.
Well, I know that I put up a post on the Love That Album Facebook group today just to say, right, well, we're going to be discussing this album tonight, recording the episode. I said that Argy Bargy is an album full of dark songs with upbeat melodies, whereas Così Fan Tutti Frutti is an album with dark lyrics and dark melodies. And the example I gave was one of the singles, Last Time Forever.
Said love would end, I read them tonight. Mistakes I can't defend. I didn't stop to think, but I have said love. I've said goodnight tonight, the last time forever.
Oh yeah.
And very much 80s. The electronic drums in there, the Lynn drums, and someone went and wrote one of my favourite squeeze songs of that era. And look, I struggle to disagree with it because there are some bands where I couldn't really sort of connect with at first because of the sound, and then later on I came back and thought, okay, the songwriting shines through. Whereas those songs on that album, right from the word go, I thought, oh, I don't like that sound, but Jesus, a good song.
Yeah.
Although, mind you, once again, there was a Tilbrook Difford album that they did just between, I think, East Side Story and Così Fan Tutti Frutti.
Yeah.
And I think I listened to that once and that was too much on the electronics.
I didn't like it. They actually did Sweets from a Stranger before that, then Disintegrated.
Okay.
And that's not an album I love either. It's got a couple of good songs on it.
For some reason, I thought that was like in the reunion.
Straight after, it was about a year after East Side Story. Yeah, and that's where I kind of left them for a while, I think. And I only really dipped my toe in here and there after that. I think we discussed like my two favourite Squeeze songs. Some Fantastic Place is probably number one.
She gave to me her tenderness, her friendship and her love. I see her face from time to time there in the sky above. We grew up learning as we went what a voyage our lives could be. It took us through a wilderness into the calmest sea.
And Tempted is number two, and yeah, there are lots of others, but that's an amazing song. It's just, it covers so much ground and it's so musically interesting.
The beauty about Some Fantastic Place is you know that it comes from a place of sincerity. I mean, for those of you who don't know the song, that was in dedication to a lady who, I don't know if she actually introduced Difford and Tilbrook or Difford had put up a sign in a local music shop saying,
that's the story,
looking for guitarists to start songwriting partnership. And she said, you go at you take that up. And she pushed me. One of those stories. So she's obviously held in a lot of love and a lot of high regard. And because it had differed as a writer, as a lyricist, there's nothing at all twee about it. It's just...
No, it's a beautiful lyric. It's
a real heartbreaker.
Yeah. Especially when you do know the story. But even if you don't, you can tell what it's all about. Yeah.
And I think that's with Pete Thomas on drums, not Gilson Lavis. So.
Yeah, I think that Gilson was long gone with Jules by then.
Playing in the Jules Holland Rhythm and Blues Orchestra, which I had the pleasure of seeing in 1996 at the Prince Charles Charity Trust concert.
Wow.
And on the same bill, I think, is The Who, Bob Dylan, Eric Clapton, and My Toilet Break of Alanis Morissette. But
all right, well, yeah, so that would have been My Toilet Break too.
Yeah.
God bless. God love her.
Absolutely. Actually, I might edit that bit out. I don't want to upset the Alanis Morissette fans out there. Let's talk about the album itself,
because
that's what we're here for. But we wanted to set up the scene about what we love about the band and what we think makes them absolutely special. And one of the themes on this album, and really, I guess, a recurring theme throughout a lot of their music is, well, I guess, people in love, which is not an uncommon approach in pop music, but the way how they do it, I mentioned like a social realist approach to songwriting before, and on a song like Separate Beds, which actually has a partner song I'll get to in a couple of moments. This is what's so beautiful when you listen to the lyrics on this. It's written by craftsmen. This is not, oh, the lyrics just came to my head. And we're not talking about them using great big words. It's not like they're sitting there with a dictionary or a thesaurus. It's just they know how to get the perfect words to describe a situation that's in their head. And one thing that I've never sort of spoken about on this show, but it's a common thing in Squeeze songs, is rhyme and meter.
Yeah.
And we get Difford who says, right, I've gone and written his lyrics. I don't know what Glenn is going to do with it. And I think that Glenn is very deliberately saying, right, I know how I want this to sound in terms of the rhythm. I mean, we take that for granted when we listen to a song, and certainly if you're a songwriter who's writing both, you consider that at the time. But there's a song which we'll probably come to later, the one Jules Holland contribution, where he's just fitting in too many words on the one line, and it's just, I want to get this line out rather than what absolutely works. But we get, tonight I take her from her parents. Yeah. I came along to her rescue. So we're getting a crotchet for every syllable on the line. I mean, normally I don't try to get to that level of brass and tacks in the description, but it seems to be like a recurring thing in a lot of Squeeze songs.
Sure. They're metrically perfect. Often when people give me lyrics to write music to, but which has happened over the years, they're so metrically chaotic that you have to say, I have to change these. You have to say it to the person. Sometimes they get a bit shirty, but... but you know, it's like how the first line has nothing in common metrically with the second or the third or the fourth, and they've just, it's just written. You can't make anything that makes any sense out of it, so you have to add words or take words away occasionally. But yeah, obviously Christopher had written enough songs by himself. I think he'd written a few Dylan-y kind of songs to start with. He knew enough to make them make sense for somebody who was going to write music for them. That's really obvious when you... I've never heard of any stories about Glenn Tillerbrook having to chop and change or tweak them in any way.
But he has the luxury of being able to compose the music around Difford's lyric, but he has enough faith in Difford as a lyricist to be able to say, right, I don't need to chop and change. And Difford thinks... Even if his guitar is turned down, and I refuse to believe it, but Difford will think like a musician when writing a lyric, and Tillbrook will have enough faith to say, you know how to tell a story, I will write the music to fit the lyric, and for me as a singer as well. I tried to think of a good example from this album. I kept coming back to songs from the other albums where you might get like a rhyming scheme where the rhyme would be on the second, fourth line of a verse and maybe the first and third line of the verse. But quite often in a Squeeze song, it'll be the first line and the second line rhyme. Boom, let's get rid of that. The third and the fourth line rhyme. Boom, let's do that. I mean, this song is not one of those examples, but I think there is one that we'll come to. But it's just what I'm trying to get at here is the meter and the rhyming schemes are very deliberate, and that's why I think they are one of the great songwriting teams, not just because of what they say, but how they say it. And everything's so deliberate. And if they decide, well, we're going to start up a school for songwriting, well, you know, I like to think that if I had a hope of being a songwriter, it would be by learning from those guys.
Yeah, for sure. Look, one thing that struck me, because I hadn't heard this, I mean, I've got this album, but I haven't, obviously I've moved on to other things. When I played this song, this is one of the Squeeze songs where I can really hear Crowded House.
Right.
Or late period Split End, probably more likely, because the beginning of this song, if I just heard it on the radio and I'd forgotten who it was, I think it was Message to My Girl.
That is such a fantastic comparison. I completely get that.
Yeah, and when I first heard, now this is a fantastic song that I've got, History Never Repeats, because I wasn't, because Neil Finney was new to, he'd been playing guitar a little while, but he wasn't a featured voice. When I first heard that on the radio, I thought that was Squeeze. So I think, obviously, Neil Finn's, we discussed this before we started, Neil Finn has moved on to amazing things. He's his own voice a million times over. But I think those early songs are very influenced by Squeeze.
And I think probably his vocal attack is borrowing something from Glenn Tilbrook as a singer as well.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I've never seen him. He always mentions the Beatles. But his voice is like this hybrid. It's common. I think you even got it with Badfinger, Pete Ham. His voice is, you can't quite pinpoint who it sounds like. It's a bit of both. I suppose anybody who's grown up listening to the Beatles who's not one of the Beatles, if you're going to sound like them, you're going to sound like a bit of both. But it's definitely there with Tilbrook. It's that slight whine of Lennon with that melodic bounce of McCartney.
Without the Little Richard influence.
Yeah, that's right. He's not a great screamer. He proved that when he tried to sing soul on one of the later albums.
So Difford had written quite a few songs over the years about sexuality. And songs that may have had, in some cases, a preoccupation with wanking or other sexual exploits. Separate Beds is sort of like a rarity, I think, in their canon.
Yeah.
That it's really a sweet tale of first love that's so innocent.
Yeah, it's about not shagging.
Yeah, exactly. But they sort of want to, but they sort of don't. But I like that it goes to other places as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They, with just a couple of lines, you know everything about their background.
My mother didn't like me. She thought I was on drugs. My mother didn't like her. She'd never peel the spuds.
Her mother didn't like me. She thought I was on drugs. My mother didn't like her. She never peeled the spuds. So from those two lines, without explicitly saying it, we know, all right, okay, one of them is from this side of the tracks and the other one is from the other side of the tracks. But without being blatantly obvious, and lines like she never peeled the spuds, I'm just sort of thinking about every British situation comedy or drama from that period. And you just sort of wonder whether they spent a lot of time watching the TV as well as reading books.
But isn't that a classic example of, instead of saying she was posh and I was common, it's an incredibly subtle way and funny way of saying the same thing.
Well, they projected onto the mothers. As you do.
If you're young, that's how you see everybody, is through the eyes of your parents, I think, until you decide not to, until you decide that maybe they might be wrong, that it doesn't matter if somebody's from the, you know, the other side of the tracks.
But you go and compare that to another song, Vicky Verkey.
Yeah.
you listen to the music, we spoke before about happy music with dark lyric, and it actually starts out sounding like, oh yeah, this is going to be one of their shagging songs.
Yeah.
And so once again, we have the contrast of the bright sounding but ultimately very dark lyric as it goes to the second half of the song, although with a sort of hopeful ending. And this one, I guess, it works as both a contrast to Separate Beds, but it's also a good companion piece for Up the Junction, because once again, we have a song about a couple and teenage pregnancy, but
yeah,
unlike Up the Junction, where our protagonist is the girl leaves him for a soldier and leaves him there with the bottle. You think, okay, by the time that the boyfriend gets out of jail, because he's been sent to jail for trying to, I think, was it rob TVs or something like that to put food on the table?
Mm.
And so she had to abort, but they decide by the end of the song that they're going to give it another go.
Yeah.
Once again, I love the turn of phrase. It's the very British turn of phrase, but it's Chris Difford's articulate turn of phrase where he says, with her hair up in his fingers, the fish and chip smell lingers. Under amber street lamps, she holds the law in her hands.
Yeah.
And it's suggestive without being British music hall dirty. It's not nudge, nudge, wink, wink, but it's so clever. She holds the law in her hands. It's taking a different phrase and turning it into something very, very different. But once again, it's setting the mood. You can see that couple there feeling each other up on the bench. And sorry to any listeners out there who probably think we shouldn't be having this conversation, but we're just talking about a song, so.
Yeah. Well, look, it's life. It's especially life in that kind of working class or lower middle class time with those people, and it's just truth. Sex was kind of hardly spoken about. It was done a fair bit, but I think he found a way to talk about it that wasn't particularly not dirty or sexist or anything. It was just, if you look at the pulling muscles from a shell, it's a very similar kind of thing.
I want to come back to that in a moment.
Yeah, sure.
Just one last thing I wanted to finish up about this song. And I know that we said, Beatles comparison, lame. Oh, if you're going to compare them overall as a band. But I'm wondering whether Difford took any inspiration from Penny Lane with that great line, for a fish and finger pie. It was years before I knew what that actually meant. But
well, look, it might be literal, because what people used to do was go and get a takeaway fish and chips and smooch while they're eating fish and chips. So it obviously can be taken two ways, but it could just be literally that he had fish and chips. Because he's mentioning the chips as well. He's not mentioning the fish. So it could be a memory.
I'm not necessarily thinking about the fish and chips that that Chris Difford writes about in Vicky Verkey, but just more about the fact that when he uses a line like, she holds the law in her hands.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah.
I just wonder if it's inspired by For Fish and Finger Pie in Penny Lane. And so you sort of think, well, McCartney wasn't necessarily a social realist writer like maybe the way how Ray Davies was.
He tried occasionally.
Wasn't that whole idea before they sort of decided, no, we'll do Sgt. Pepper, weren't they going to make this album about life in Liverpool? And if they'd carried on with a whole album full of songs that were like Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane, that would have been really an interesting album. And I think they could have had it in them. I mean, In My Life was a great start, but
I don't know what happened there. It's Sgt. Pepper's.
We're not going to knock that. But
that's another one of those lines, because it could just mean that I think it does mean that she holds the power in her hands to either make it a good night for him or a bad night for him.
Right. or the law is a euphemism for what I can't say on the family friendly show.
No. Yeah, but I think that's the beauty of many lyrics, is that you can sort of take them, because I guess if you're saying that to somebody literally, it means they have control. I suppose she does. They do it down on canvas hands, they do it at Waikiki. Blazing about the beach all day at night, the crickets creeping. Squinting faces at the sky. A Harold Robbins paperback. Surfers drop their balls and dry.
Let's move to Pulling Muscles from a Shelf.
It's really just a dirty holiday story, really, isn't it? That it's, again, just so packed with detail. And as somebody who spent his very early years going to places like this, not old enough to experience things like this, but certainly experiencing chalets and muscles and arcades and fat ladies. And
so is this like the Butlins holiday camps we keep hearing
yeah,
about?
Yeah, look, there were two differing... There was Butlins and Pontins, and uh-huh. Pontins were slightly more upmarket, but they were both... what they both really were was prisoner war camps.
Oh. Thanks for bringing the tone of the show down, Shane.
Because the... In fact, a lot of people used to call Butlins butlets. You know, every chalet had a speaker in it, and you'd get woken up by reveille at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you have to go out and start doing these activities. You know, you couldn't sleep in. Imagine if you're a man who's been working in a Sheffield steelwork for 6 days a week, and then you get to go like for a week in a year holiday. And as soon as you get there, you get woken up at 6 o'clock by a whistle and say, wakey, wakey, everybody. And just such a memory for me. Kids love it, of course. They don't care, you know, but the whole thing with Butlins and Pontins was to keep people occupied yep. at all times and not to let them be the idle working class and just lie around and do nothing. So the whole song is set in that world. Yeah, I think that the man in the song, I think the protagonist is a redcoat, which are the people that work at the holiday camps. They get the first pick of all the birds that turn up every 2 weeks. Yeah, behind the chalet, the holiday's complete. Well, it is for her, but for him, it's just turnaround. It'll probably happen again in a week or 2 weeks' time. It's just that what happened, it's that world.
See, look, I had gone and bought into the common conception for many years that this song was about wanking, you know, pulling right. muscles from the shell. And then in prep for this episode, I'm sort of really having a read of the lyrics and thinking, oh, no, it's more about sex, isn't it? You know, made Marianne on her tiptoe right. feet. It's
and if you're wanking, she ain't there.
Right, and I think someone had gone and said that the holiday's complete not because you're having a wank behind the shed, because you can have a wank anywhere.
That's right. You know, I mean, aside from the lyric, which is obviously a playful look at a holiday dalliance with a bit of extra detail, you know, the chord sequence is... It's just... It's what they do a lot. The verses are complex. And then it's the same with the next song. I mean, it's a real 1-2 punch, isn't it? This and the next song, but very tricky verse sections and then really quite simple chorus sections.
I think the secret to the success, first of all, from pulling muscles, and we'll get to Another Nail in My Heart shortly, but I think what is part of the success of pulling muscles is the bass line on this song. Yeah. So that's John Bentley on this album?
I think so, yeah.
They're playing A minor, but with a dropping bass line over each bar or so.
Yeah.
And his bass playing that makes it sound probably more complex than it really is.
Yeah.
And I'm absolutely crazy about what they do with it here. And it's, if you're listening to it for the first time, you can't predict where they're going to go next. And that's the level of complexity. It's not like it's, I don't necessarily think it's in the prog element like what XTC were doing it.
No.
But it's certainly a song that your early pop guitar player is not going to be able to play, or certainly your first time listener is going to be able to predict where it was. I mean, yes, obviously we get pleasure hearing a song and being able to think, oh yeah, I knew you were going to go there, but I take great delight in being able to think, oh, I didn't know you were going to do that. Wow, that's a great turn of phrase. A lot of clean, and that's what makes it so exciting, I think.
It's nice to be surprised. I mean, again, I think to bring back the name again, it's somewhat in the Bacharach tradition in that way, that Bird Bacharach would often mess around with meter and really odd chord changes and still make it sound like a pop song, which is the skill, because anybody can whack together a whole bunch of strange chords and make one of the bars in 3-4 and the next bar in 5-4. You can, if you know what you're doing, you can do that. It's whether you can turn it into a pop song or not.
Right.
That is the trick. The other thing I like about this song is in the chorus, Tilbrook just whacks this, I think you're right, it's the A minor chord.
Yep.
And he just stays on that chord, whereas everybody else changes through the chorus. And it actually shouldn't work, because they clash it a couple of times. It just keeps going all the way through that chorus, and it's a neat trick. It's what I call an ear tickler. It makes you think, oh, very clever. I don't even know if it was that big a hit. I know it was a single, so I remember seeing a clip of it, but I don't think either of the two songs were actually really big hits. They might have got been top 20 in England or something.
I don't think there were hits here. I mean, as I said at the start of the show, Tilbrook commended us for having dumped them after Cool for Cats. Certainly, you know, whenever I went to see Tilbrook live, everyone knew every word to this song.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, their fans are their fans. I think they're sort of... hit their peak as far as hit singles go. But anyway, it doesn't matter. It's lasted. The song still sounds amazing.
I guess we could say this about Squeeze. Songs are deceptively simple. You listen to it and you think, if you're not a musician, you can still listen to it. You still enjoy it and you hum along with it. And this is a very singable, hummable song.
Yeah, for sure.
But when we're listening to this as musicians, we're thinking, well, where did you pull that from? And actually, the other thing I sort of just thought about, and I'm coming back to the bass line, as well as the chord structure in the verse, is it's very mathematical. And I don't know, maybe on the one hand, you should say, just enjoy the song for what it is, but... boom, 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 and then boom, 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 boom. It seemed very symmetrical, very mathematical, and yet still very musical, and that's what makes it very squeezy to me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's that combination of accessibility and cleverness, which I think most of my favourite bands have that in one way or another. I like my obscure stuff as much as anybody, but
you've
got to be in the mood for some things. I can listen to Squeeze anytime, really. If they come on the radio, which is rare. If they do, it's cool for cats, but you know, when they do, it's always or if they come up on shuffle or something, so it's a nice pleasure to... So
maybe we ought to start a petition. Get Pulling Muscles from a Shell played on radio. It's a really innocent song, we promise.
Yeah.
Then again, in an era where they're singing songs like Fuck You on top 40 radio, then you know, this probably is very innocent.
Well, it is in a way. I mean, because there's so much cynicism in all that stuff. It's not innocent at all. It's completely thought out and aimed at a certain somebody who wants to be naughty or...
They're not going nudge, nudge, wink, wink. They're just telling a story.
Yeah. I just think it's probably not great to spend too much time begrudging young people's music, except if you know how it's made and why it's made, it's hard not to be cynical either. Bands like this and in this era, it's probably between 63 and 83. It's never been the same since as far as rock music goes, I don't think, or what you might consider pop or rock.
Sure.
Probably because there was plenty of money around, and so... nobody was under any pressure, really, to come up with the good straight away or hits or whatever. I mean, there was pressure, of course, but it was just different. They were given 3 or 4 albums to develop and lots of different factors and why it's not the same now. It's why we have an Ed Sheeran now rather than an Elvis Costello, I think. It's just a different time and the requirements of artists are different now.
You're listening to Love That Album, episode 122 with a couple of old men.
Get off my lawn!
Yeah, we've heard it all, Sonny.
Yeah. We know what a song, you call that a song?
That's the problem, isn't it, though? Because I think the more music you hear, especially if, like you, we're not overly old, but we're familiar with most of the eras. Once you've heard a lot of stuff, you start hearing where everything comes from, and it's hard to sort of take it for what it is, because you know exactly where they've got that bit from on that bit, and just go, you know, your own history sort of gets in the way of enjoying things sometimes.
Nail in My Heart, the second song in the album. And we're not doing the song by song thing, but this is a 1-2 punch. And I sort of think that this was, in a way, a very brave move, because this is a great album. But I think that their first two songs on the album were the strongest ones. And you would sort of think, right, well, we might even start off with the first single.
Isn't Separate Beds after that too?
A Separate Beds is the third one. But
and it's not a single, but it's a pretty strong tune.
there's nothing I dislike on this album, but I think that that is a great 1-2-3 punch.
It's funny, I was, when I was listening to it, I was thinking, because when Farfisa Beat came on, I remember it not being a track I loved when I used to love this album, when I used to thrash it in my bedroom when I was, you know, 20. Listening to it, I was walking and I was listening to it today and I thought, this is so precise, this song. It's so, I actually really like it now. It's not a great song particularly, and it's not one of their great classics, but it's just so well put together and it rocks like hell and it's so tight. And I admire it more now than I did then.
So Another Nail in My Heart.
Yeah.
This is a great song about infidelity. I wouldn't necessarily say that the narrator is unreliable, but he is certainly someone who doesn't understand what's the big deal. Okay, well, I cheated. Okay, well, she's up and left me, but really, is it the worst thing in the world? He's saying, I fucked up. Now I'm going to pay for it. Yeah. What's the big deal? Now I got to listen to crappy songs of sorrow at the piano bar. And I love that line, I want to be good, is that not enough?
That's right.
He's not taking ownership of what he's done.
That's a very young man kind of thing, isn't it, though? I think it's
right.
I think we all have that, oh, what did I do? Kind of thing when we're 18 or 20 or 21. I think, you know, what's the big deal? I think it's clever, really, because it takes a bit of self-knowledge to write something like that. Because if you write that, it means that you've thought about it. And it doesn't mean you believe it. It means you've thought about it and you think, well, that's a bit of a silly thing to think. The whole song's got that vibe about it, hasn't it? It's like
it does. And to come up with the bleeding obvious, it just melodicizes like anything and it rocks like anything. Just taking away from the song for the moment, I know that a song shouldn't be sold by its film clip. A song stands in its own right. And this one certainly does. But have you seen the film clip for this?
Yeah. Not for a long time. I remember Jules Holland, but he's got a cigar in his mouth or something.
I think he has a cigar in his mouth in just about every other song, not this one.
All right, okay.
So it features the band minus Jules playing on a set, and we see shots of Jules Holland pushing an upright piano through the street.
Right, yes. It's like
he's trying to make his way to the session, and it's interspersed with bits where the whole band are sitting at a bar or standing at the bar, and Jules Holland's behind the bar. He's the bartender and giving them their drinks, and they're just dancing around, and that's all on the chorus. But the main part of it is them playing on the set, and towards the very end of the song, he pushes the piano onto the set. He's got it off the street, and then there's that final glissando.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just such a clever moment. Visuals don't really sell the song, but it's just such a lovely visual moment. You think, okay, this has been thought about it, and even if the band didn't come up with the idea, whoever did probably told them, and they thought, yeah, we can live with that. That's a good idea for a clip.
I wonder if they already knew that he was leaving at this stage, and it might have been a bit of a backhanded comment about that, because he did leave pretty well soon after this was put out. It certainly wasn't on the next one.
Yeah, that's for sure. I don't know like whether album 3 and he was out. So you said that you read the biography. Oh, you read Chris Difford's biography.
Yeah.
Because he came back a few years later. So obviously there was no maliciousness
at the time.
But what did Jules want to do?
Oh, I think he just wanted to play Boogie Woogie. And like he gets to do it on this song. It's a great piano solo, actually. And what he's best at, I think he realized that Squeeze were always going to be a band that would do all kinds of different things. And he really just wanted to do one thing, which hasn't been true, really. He's become a guy that can... He's obviously more interested in roots music and jazz and blues.
Although fair play to him. I mean, he's been doing that later show for years and years, and he's prepared to give a voice to all these other bands which have nothing to do with jazz and blues. He would have thought that he might have decided, right, well, I've got the name. I'm going to champion that. Didn't he do a documentary, jazz and blues documentary?
He's done a few. He's done one about London music. It's on YouTube. That's really good. And he did one about New Orleans. Mainly what I remember about that is Lee Dorsey coming out, sweeping a broom and singing, working in a coal mine.
As a small child, I dreamt about playing in a band. I did. And it's a bit of a coincidence because they're on the show tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, Squeeze.
Let's talk a little bit about some other songs on this album. We already said before that the whole Beatles comparison, they've molded in the classic singer-songwriter thing. But there are three songs on this album that reminds me of what their peers were doing. And I'm not saying there's plagiarism or theft or whatever, but obviously they're all hanging out, all listening to each other. And there were maybe sounds rather than necessarily songs that sounded, or production techniques or maybe turns of phrase that sounded really cool. So the first one, If I Didn't Love You, makes me think of Jesus of Cool Labor of Lust era Nick Lowe.
I hate you, watching you play in the
sure. Yeah.
It must have something as much to do, and this is something we haven't sort of mentioned yet, but whereas a lot of bands, they have two great singers who sing in harmony, but what separates Difford and Tilbrook from the rest is you've got Difford singing maybe two or three octaves in unison down from Glenn Tilbrook, and that was really, really distinctive. And I think that's something, I don't think Nick Lowe ever sort of did that, but there's something about his voice that reminds me of Chris Difford, and this song, there's something, this tough song.
Yeah.
We're not talking about Cruel to Be Kind, Nick Lowe, but maybe Breaking Glass.
Yeah, for sure. That, yeah, Jesus is a Cool era. Little Hitler and all those kind of slightly quirky, when he was really trying to be quirky. It didn't last very long. I think you want to become more of just a classic kind of straight pop songwriter, really. But
well, I guess having Johnny Cash as your father-in-law means you're sort of going to go into that songwriter mode at some stage.
Straighten up the act a little bit.
Yeah.
I think he wrote Endless Grey Ribbing, hoping that Johnny Cash would record it. I think he actually did.
Yes.
Eventually. I think it took a while. But yeah, I mean, that's definitely got that vibe about it. And that was all over the shop in England at that time. That slightly twisted humour as well. You know, the jumping record thing. You can imagine Nick Lowe doing that.
Completely. Yeah,
he sings a line about, I haven't got the lyrics in front of me, but about the record scratched. And as soon as he sings that, he sings, about 10 times.
Yeah.
If you hadn't caught the line, you'd think, what are you doing that for? It's weird. And then at the end, he has two scratches. He kind of goes, if I didn't.
That's right.
It's very, very quirky. The song itself, so, you know, they probably sabotaged themselves by doing that with that song, because it might have been a little bit more of a...
You know what? I think that the British top 40 of the time, I mean, when you think about some of the bands like, I don't know, Adam and the Ants, for instance. I think the British top 40 buying public were quite accepting of quirk. I mean, obviously, maybe they weren't calling it alternative rock at the stage, but obviously, you know, that strain were listening and quite accepting of that. But I think even the top 40 buying public in Britain, and certainly in Australia, were quite happy to accept something that was a bit quirky as long as there was a great melody. And whilst I don't compare this to Adam and the Ants melodically or anything like that, but maybe that level of quirk.
Certainly, a public that could accept things like Dexys Midnight Runners, anything like that. And the British were good at that. It seems to have disappeared a little bit now as far as quirkiness goes. I think that's, maybe it'll come back, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, that's right. Certainly that period, nobody was trying to take themselves too seriously. I'm sure they all took what they did seriously, but I don't think anybody was taking themselves overly seriously. Yeah, which is, I think it's very healthy.
Yeah.
You need a bit more. Well, you actually have to look around and see, you know, I mean, I think there's too much at stake for people these days. You know, the culture, the subculture for that is elsewhere. I think they're interested in other things. I don't know what, but anyway. Yeah, so you're right. That song does kind of sit in that kind of subgroup, that, you know, that slightly quirky.
Well, I got another couple of songs that would fit in that slightly quirky sort of vein, but for different reasons. So the second song that I think works as a good companion piece to a contemporary act is Here Comes That Feeling. We discussed XTC, who were obviously in love with older pop, yet definitely had a more contemporary sound for the time, particularly in the Barry Andrews era.
Yeah.
And Here Comes That Feeling really seems to me like they might have been listening to what XTC were doing in that period. And the drumming seems like Lavis is taking a note. It's very heavy, taking a note at something that Terry Chambers might have done. I'm not necessarily saying it's, you know, conscious, but it just brings that to mind. And you get an expression in the song, "Egg on the Shirt of My Heart." Is that a line that Andy Partridge might have written? I like to think
so. Yeah. I mean, what's this album contemporary with Drums and Wires, really, isn't it?
I think. Yes, I guess it would have been that same year.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, it's not so much the keyboards anyway, really, is it? It's more the lyric and the drum feel, and I don't think it particularly sounds like XTC. I think it just might be something that was in the air at the time. But yeah, you could be right. Mm. I didn't think it when I heard it again.
Well, I'll run one more by you, see what you think of this. And I think I'm a go-go.
Well, it sounds like something off Cool for Cats. You know, it's that feel. It's almost Latin, isn't it? I don't know.
I'm placing it in the Baroque pop camp.
Yeah. And
this song sounds to me actually like someone who hadn't actually recorded the album in this style. And I'm talking about the aforementioned Elvis Costello. This sounds to me like a song that could have fit on Imperial Bedroom.
Yeah.
It couldn't fit on this year's model or Armed Forces, but maybe Elvis was paying attention. I mean, he produced the next album, for goodness sake. So
yeah, that's right, yeah. Oh, he was a fan of Chris Difford's. That's one thing I wanted to run by you. I mean, you know, like, they obviously had a big hit with Cool for Cats, and then you'd think the natural move would be to get Difford to sing couple more on this one, and they didn't do that. I think it might have been a good move not to do that, because it's a kind of gimmicky voice in a way. He only sings part of this one. Well, he sings all through it as his lower octave harmony. I say that with inverted. He couldn't actually sing harmonies. He could only sing an octave lower than...
Yes.
So he only sings one whole song by himself, and it's probably smart that they didn't actually feature him more, even though he'd sort of given him that big hit.
I suspect that he was quite happy doing what he did, and he probably didn't want to be the focus of attention.
Yeah, probably right.
And given that the band actually sort of hit their strides at this stage in England for a while, and in America to some extent for a little while, they probably didn't need to put anything out with him as the lead vocalist.
No.
As a singer. And really, when you've got a voice like Glenn Tilbrook's, why would put that on a top 40 single?
You got to put yourself into the place of a cloth-eared record executive who's seen some money come in from somebody singing a song. And I suppose the classic example would be Diana Ross with the Supremes, because she was the worst singer in the Supremes. And I guess because, well, for various reasons, she was pushed to the front. I could have just seen them under pressure from some idiot at A&M saying, get him to sing a few more, let's get another hit out, you know, which didn't happen.
Right.
You know, it's they're to be commended if that happened, that they didn't. Well, there were a million bands around at the time too, weren't there? I mean, you know, I find myself disparaging the 80s in lots of ways. By remembering all the rubbish that seemed to happen sort of more towards the mid-80s than towards the end. And it was just awful, and it sort of drove me to playing the blues. But I also remember how amazing it was earlier on, and just how much, especially from England, how much incredible stuff that was coming out that was just doing my head in, how good it was.
How did you afford to buy that record collection?
Well, I was working. Yeah. I used to buy one or two albums a week, buying smartly and going to secondhand places.
Right.
And I still have most of them, I think. I haven't sold very much, so I've still got all my Dexys and XTC and Squeeze and Joe Jackson and all these things that are, you know, The Clash. They were all just putting a lot of stuff out, and it was all interesting. Not all brilliant. I mean, some of them overreached. You know, that's to be expected when you're making one album a year or more.
Right. Well, I mean, at what stage did it become the thing to say, right, we're putting out an album every 2 years, which was the antithesis of the 60s era. We need two albums a year and half a dozen singles, and need to tour to promote them.
I know. It's amazing that people could do that. And I think you can only keep it up for so long. You know, people have only got so many songs in them. I think the gaps that some people take are ridiculous, but I think two a year is too much. I think it isn't if you're not writing the songs. It's fine if somebody else is writing the songs for you.
Mm.
Which is what happens with the country acts in America. You know, they churn them out because they're not writing the songs. You know.
Or you get a social experiment like what King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard did last year, with putting in five albums, I think.
Yeah, there's another new band that's interesting, you know, they're doing interesting things. It's just to prove us wrong. Yeah. Oh, well, me wrong. You're probably a bit more... Yeah. It's it's how it should be. It's probably going back to what it should be, you know, a massive cottage industry where people aren't sort of under the... I mean, you know, there were some great A&R men through the 60s, 70s and 80s who probably we wouldn't have the things that we have without them, but they've also been responsible for some awful stuff as well.
I had a couple of notes here about a couple of songs that I thought were misfires. We've already gone to Sid Fafi's a beat.
No.
Wrong Side of the Moon.
Across the ocean she's been waiting to hear. It blows a secret to all the things she fears. Words are tiptoe around when pillow talk. Become the only voice you hear with any thought.
I'm not really big on Jules' song either. It's okay, but I see why they shoved it on the end.
Like it wasn't a B-side.
Although, yeah, yeah.
Mind you, I think I've sort of read that they had a ton of B-sides.
And yeah.
Like if they'd gone and put out a CD collection, and there may well be something that they released just to their fans of the 200-300 B-sides that they recorded. I think sometimes you can get a band that has some gems and you think, how did this get left off?
Yeah.
But by its virtual status as a novelty song, I think Wrong Side of the Moon would have been a great B-side, you know, a good song that you're happy to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, does it work on this album? Yeah, maybe not. But as he was saying before, he wanted to do blues and boogie-woogie, and who knows, maybe he does that with his rhythm and blues orchestra, don't know.
I doubt it somehow. It's like definitely of its time. It sounds kind of like a bit desperate to me. It sounds like I'm going to write this song. Did he write it?
Yes, I think he did.
As a whole, that album's, you know, it is, as, you know, my favourite. Like we said before, it's my favourite as a whole Squeeze album, but it doesn't have my favourite Squeeze song on it. I don't know how common that is, but it's. I think I'm Go-Go. I love Separate Beds, Pulling Muscles from Michelle, Another Nail in My Heart. But I remember when I got East Side Story, I actually thought it was a masterpiece.
Yes.
And I'm not sure if it is now, but...
I definitely think it is.
Okay. Well, I'll have to have another listen to it. It's been a while since I played it. I mean, I hear Tempted all the time because, you know, I often play it to people who don't know it, and I always say, listen, cop this. And then it always affects people the same way it did to me when I first heard it. It's just a classic Diffident Tillerbrook song with great detailed lyrics, again, about chuffing off for a bit of a dirty weekend, I think. He certainly shoved his voice on a few hit singles in his time, old Paul Carrack.
But I sort of think Paul Carrack, and I'm thinking The Living Years or Tempted. We can put The Living Years to the dustbin of time. Sorry, any Mike and the Mechanics fans out there. But yeah. Tempted, wow, what a voice.
Yeah, plus he sang How Long, you know, that's a great single.
Yeah.
From an earlier era. It's another one of those songs that just seems to just fall out of the air. And
I'm trying to think, what album did he come back for? Was it some fantastic place that he came back for?
Yeah, he sang another song, didn't he, Loving You Tonight?
Yes, that's right. Yep, he did too.
Nice. It's a nice kind of...
It's not vintage.
No, it could have come being on one of his solo albums. It's a kind of generic kind of soul tune, really. I think they wrote it for him. See, I don't think they wrote Tempted for Paul Carrack. I think...
No, well, that was Elvis Costello's suggestion. Hey, why don't you give it to him? And those lines, you know, that second verse where you hear low vocal, people keep on riding and wishing... Yeah. That was Elvis.
Yeah, that's right.
I didn't realise that.
And plus, Tillerbrook sings the line before that. I'm at the airport, the car park, the Barry's Carousel. That's actually Tillerbrook singing that part.
Yeah, that much was obvious, but I saw that low vocal, oh yeah, that's going to be Chris Difford. And it is in the film clip, but on the record, it's Elvis Costello.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's actually, when I first heard it, it was fairly obvious to me. When Difford sings low, it's got this kind of rasp to it, whereas when Elvis goes down there, it's full.
Yes.
Some Fantastic Place and Tempted to my two. If I had to pick two, which I never have to do, thankfully, if I had to, I'd pick those two. But I still like this album.
If you were asked to go sing in a tribute band, a Squeeze tribute band, you can have any two songs you want, Shane. What are the two you are going to sing? Boom, there
you
go.
Well, I think I could do a fairly good job on Tempted. It's in my bailiwick, you know, as far as singing goes. Paul Carrack's from Sheffield like I am, so we obviously have exactly the same voice.
Everyone in Sheffield sings the same, don't they?
They do. Well, Joe Cocker, Paul Carrack and me. That's it, you know. But no.
Birds of a feather.
I'd have a bash at that. I'm not sure if I could. I might cry if I sang some Fantastic Place. Yeah, I'd probably have a go at Tempted and Pulling Muscle from Michelle, because that'd be fun to sing, I think.
Good.
Yeah.
If you're a braver man than I am. Well, or, I mean, my, I wasn't given the opportunity. Because I misunderstood the song to begin with. There was a song, Touching Me, Touching You.
I'm always touching myself. I've got nothing else.
that was their wanking song.
I mean, there's been a few wanking songs, haven't there? It's for a subject that's meant to be not. I think Turning Japanese was a wanking song.
Well, they've denied it, but I think they're just playing with their heads. I think it's probably about time that we finish this up. Any final thoughts on this album?
Yeah, people should have a listen to it, and people who want to learn how to write pop rock songs should use it as a bit of a primer, I think, because it's almost, well, it's just squeezed generally, I think, but this album just hangs together. And the other thing I was going to say, the production between, I know John Wood did both of them, but the sound of the albums between Cool for Cats and this one was so much better, much kind of just sparkled a bit more, still keeping that nice warm drum sound. And
well, I'm glad that they recorded this in 1980 rather than in 1985, 1986 when they had the reunion, because imagine, you know, when they decided, oh well, let's do what other 80s bands are doing, and they could have had these great songs and they would have been marred. I mean, look, they learned their lesson, because by the time they got to Babylon or not, they found their pop loving mojo again, and it sounds like an album that they recorded in 1979-1980.
So that would have been what, early 90s, I would say, wouldn't it?
I think it's about 86.
Okay.
When,
87. Yeah, well, I think that kind of sound had sort of had its time, hadn't it? There was more, the rootsy stuff was starting to appear again, even in the British scene, the sort of prefabricated sound was on its way out, I think.
And I think they probably just realised what was best for them.
Yeah, well, that's right.
They knew they weren't supposed to sound like the Dream Academy, and they weren't supposed to sound like Yazoo. They were just supposed to sound like Squeeze, and that's what they did.
Isn't it tragic when you get a compilation of an artist that's been making records for a long time, and that the early stuff all sounds so beautiful, and then you hit the 80s and you suddenly immediately get hit by all these gated drums and reverbs that you hate, and they all start sounding like Reverb Company ads, you know, and and then if they're good enough, you can hear them come out of that. I've got a Jackson Browne compilation, and oh man, some of the 80s stuff just sounds awful. Then he sort of comes out of it and he's back to basically the sound that he had before.
The 80s were our friends, but then again, there were some producers in the 90s, or maybe more the noughties, who have got a lot to answer for. There's one guy in particular I'm thinking of who wrecked a couple of Springsteen and the E Street Band reunion albums.
I know how you mean.
Way too much sheen and reverb.
Plus, that's when the loudness wars were at their peak, so everything sounds awful. I mean, there's a couple of albums, they really should be classics, but they just sound so disgusting that I can't listen to them. But anyway, we don't, like you said, we want to keep it positive.
We do.
The loudness wars are now over, I think. I'm hearing stuff now that doesn't sound like it's been pushed to the max, because that's the worst aspect of all of this, is that horrible kind of brick wall mastering that's just ruined so many records, especially from that period, 90s.
So there you go, a couple of old men discussing Argy Bargy. We sort of went to all number of sorts of places, but to be absolutely honest with you, I think I prefer a show where we go to a million and one places. I mean, if a new listener sort of thinks, oh, what's this podcast? They're going to talk about Argy Bargy, I'll tune in. And they might say, I'm never listening to that show again. They've just gone all over the place. But I think it makes for a more interesting conversation.
I think that's, if you're talking about music honestly and you're not trying to flog anything, then you're going to go to places. Yeah,
it's what we would do if we were having a beer at the pub, I think.
Well, anyway, I enjoyed it. I enjoy talking about this stuff.
Well, thank you so very much once again, Shane, for being a part of the show. This is show number 3 for you, and I look forward already to show number 4, whatever that will be.
We'll think of something.
We will, no doubt. Look, just one regret is that Jeff Perlman wasn't available for this month. Now, I think I got him booked for next month, but he may pull out. I'm not 100% sure. We'll talk in a moment about what's happening next month.
Yeah.
Just quickly, once again, where can people find you if they want some great dirty down, low down, funky blues stylings from your good self, if they want to hear the music of the Bondi Cigars or the Shane Pacey Trio? So either through recorded means, or if they want to follow you because they say, I want to fly up to Sydney see those fine musicians.
Like you did, but no, just recently.
Well, I flew up to Sydney, but you weren't playing yet.
Bondi Cigars and the Trio both have web pages and Facebook pages. You just have to look them up. And I've also got a solo album out, an acoustic album, but it's only digital, so you can find that on if you just look up my name, Shane Pace, it's called The Gardener. It's very much the other thing that I do that I've never exposed to the world, which is my obsession with people like Bert Jansch and John Renborn and people like that. Yeah, so that's available digitally, not in any hard. So you can listen to it on Spotify or Apple Music, or there. If you go to Green South Records website, you can download it there.
Mm. It's called The Gardener.
The Gardener, yeah. So it's very much.
When you mention Bert Jansch, now I'm all over it. Oh, that's it. Yeah, I want to hear that.
Yeah, I record it right where I'm sitting now with one microphone, and it's meant to sound like a garden acoustic guitar sitting right in front of you singing, and then I just embellished it here and there with little bits of stringed instruments that just to what I call, again, ear ticklers. So, yeah, I think if you like that kind of thing, you might find some stuff on there that's to your taste.
So is this all original material, Shane, or are you doing your interpretations of Bert Jansch, John Renborn tunes?
No, it's mainly original. There's two covers. I do a version of the John Hiatt and Ry Cooder song, Across the Borderline.
Oh, yes.
And a version of Sinning Limbo, the Jimmy Cliff tune. But yes, the covers aren't of that, but the originals are sort of in that vein. But it's just from a time when I was first separated from my ex, and I was here by myself, and I just sort of started doing it for something to do, and I put one little clip up on Facebook, and it got a massive response, and Dave from Green South contacted me and said, if you've got any more of this stuff, I'll be interested in putting it out. And that's how it happens sometimes.
Wow. So Google it, folks. Shane Pacey, The Gardener.
Yeah.
And if you either download it from that website or bring it up in Spotify, if that's your choice of listening to music. And now I'm just sort of thinking that we have an informal commitment that yourself, myself, and Jeff Perlman will do an episode talking about our favorite blues albums. But I'm thinking post that, I'd love to discuss a Pentangle album with you. I've been waiting to find someone who really loves their music. So I think we'll maybe do a Bert Jansch solo album and a Pentangle album.
Yeah, look, I have every Pentangle album here.
I've no doubt. When I was about 7 or 8 years old, my older sister, who had normally only exposed me to classical music, but her one exception was English folk, and we had a copy of Basket of Light, and I played that album to death. So
yeah, they were amazing. Yeah. There's been nothing like them since. There was nothing like them before. You know, and the rhythm section swung like a bitch. And,
Danny Thompson is one of my heroes as a bass player, my God.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. So I'm happy to talk about that till the cows come home.
Right, well, we'll be doing that a few months down the track on this very podcast.
Sounds good to me.
So let's just get by through the housekeeping things. If you want to get in contact, you can email me at rrrkitchen@yahoo.com.au. You can join the Facebook group, going facebook.com/groups/LoveThatAlbum. If you wish to hear me blathering on about films, in particular music-related films, then I'd love it if you could join us on my other podcast with my great friends Tim Merrill and Bernard Stickwell. We talk about music-related films on a show called See Here. That's S-E-H-E-A-R. This month of March, we're going to be talking about fantastic documentary, very important one that a lot of people say was the nail in the coffin of the 60s. I'm talking about Gimme Shelter, the documentary about the Stones at Altamont. But we'll be talking about probably the whole Rolling Stones filmography, because it seems like every time they went out on stage, there was a camera pointed at them. There's a ton of Rolling Stones films. So we'll be talking about that on this month's episode of See Here. Probably should just briefly talk about what we're going to be doing in April of 2019. Now, the original plan was that I was going to be joined by music and film writer Heather Drain, who's also been on the show a couple of times in recent months, and it's a pleasure to have her back. And the original plan was that I'd invited her on and Jeff Perlman to talk about Todd Rundgren, a couple of Todd Rundgren albums. But Heather went and wrote me back and said, you know what, I've had a change of heart. I really, really, really want to talk about the Kinks, and which is a nice companion piece to this. So rather than discussing the album that it would be 50 years old this year, which is Arthur, we're going to go for an album that's 49 years old this year, because an album we're both crazy about. That's Lola versus Powerman and the Money Ground Part 1. If you've not heard this album, you know Lola, you know Ape Man. So two really iconic songs from the Kinks on that album, but we'll no doubt be discussing about where they went from this, what had happened before this. A very important album, an album that Ray Davies was possibly very bitter about the state of the music industry, because it did him over. And never piss off a great lyricist, because they make you pay for it. So we'll be talking about that album. with Heather. I haven't sort of conferred with Jeff Perlman as to whether he wants to take part in talking about the Kinks. He's welcome to do so. Hopefully he'll join us. But if he wants to join us the following month, another great writer about film, Kerry Fristo, will be joining me to pick up the slack that Heather dropped in talking about Todd Rundgren. So in May, we'll be talking about Something Anything by Todd Rundgren. So Jeff Perlman, if you're listening to this, you're welcome to join us for both months as well, if you wish, or just one. Or if you say, no, just want to talk with the great Shane Pacey, then I'll wait till we're talking about the Blues or Burt Jansch. Whatever. I'm so free and easy on this show. You can tell I don't plan anything well. I'm rambling. So what I'm going to do now is say farewell. Thank you very much for joining in and listening to this month's episode of Love That Album. It was 122. Next month will be episode 123, if my arithmetic is correct. So until next month, look after each other. Go listen to a Shane Pacey album. Go listen to a Bondi Cigars album. And just generally be nice to each other, because the world is pretty fucked up at the moment. So please hug someone that you love, and we'll catch you next month. All the best. Cheers.
And you know it's too late to change your mind. When you've paid the price and come so far, just to end up where you are, and you're still just across the borderline. Up and down the Rio Grande, thousand footsteps in the sand reveal a secret that no one can define.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.